content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story from the fiction section of the January 31st, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine. Long Distance by Asikal Savas. Leah changed the sheets when she got up. She'd bought flowers the previous day, tulips that she'd put on the dresser. There were carnations on the kitchen table in a squat glass vase. She thought they looked cheerful and not too fussy. The fridge was filled with more things than they would be able to eat. Olives, jams, prosciutto, cheeses. She'd bought wine and beer, cookies, breads, the round tirale crackers that were common in Roman cafes. She didn't think they'd be staying home very much. There were so many places she wanted to take Leo. But she had in mind a scene of the two of them eating in bed. Did people really do that? It seemed as though there would be too much of a mess, nowhere to put your plate. Still, she liked the idea. The sleepy indulgence, the sheets streaked with light, the hour, in her imagination, was late afternoon, which may have been the reason for the beer. Though this particular timing would require some planning, with everything else she wanted to do with him. Her phone buzzed. Just landed. We'll take a taxi over as soon as I'm out. I can't wait to get there, she thought, alternatively, or finally. But maybe this was Leo's way of elevating the anticipation further, not allowing any release with words. They hadn't communicated very much in the past weeks, after Leo bought his ticket. Whereas before that they had written almost daily, talked on the phone for an hour, sometimes two. The relationship was still new. They spoke to each other in the hush of mystery. This was different from their time in California, where Leah had been doing research for a semester. Leah worked as an engineer in a neighboring town. They hadn't met until the last month of Leah's stay. Then there had been something embarrassing about their late-night returns to her apartment after dinners at the home of mutual friends. A secret, though not a thrill. On Leah's last weekend, they'd gone to a restaurant together to dignify the situation with a formal parting. But once Leah was in Rome, the emails they exchanged to say goodbye had suddenly become tender. Their messages thickened with a new vocabulary. Leah wrote to him about the city, the banks of the river in the early morning, the market stalls closing in the afternoon, the kiosk where she drank her coffee. She went to small, out-of-the-way museums, in part to tell Leo about them, to have him see her as someone curious and passionate. She was in Rome as a postdoctoral fellow in linguistics. She took the metro to the university, an unremarkable place with fascist architecture, and ate lunch in the campus cafe with other researchers. They formed a group and met on weekends for drinks or hikes. Leah had always felt comfortable among academic types, their measured enthusiasms and logical worldview, their adaptability. But these were not the things she wrote about to Leo. She wanted to portray another version of herself, a young woman in Rome, enchanted by life. Leah told her that he looked forward to her emails. He enjoyed picturing her in this city he'd never seen, where she seemed entirely at ease. Without their exchange, Leah might have been disappointed in Rome, having always imagined it as something more, consistent perhaps, or harmonious. Writing to Leo provided a vantage point, a way to sift and sort, to separate the beauty from the ungainliness. She went downstairs when she heard the taxi pull up. Leo stepped out of the car with a clutter of things, coat, sweater, backpack, headphones falling off his neck. He was different from how she remembered, smaller and paler. His expression was confused. Leah shouted some phrases to the driver. Thank you, good day, thank you again. Maybe too loud, too eager to show off her Italian. Hello, Leo said. They kissed, somewhere between cheek and lips. Upstairs, they put the suitcase in the bedroom and then sat in the kitchen. Leo wasn't very hungry. He picked at the cut-up fruits she put in a bowl.
"Would you like to take a nap?"
"No," Leo said. "Then I'd sleep all day. We'd better go out before the fatigue kicks in."
"Of course I don't want to take a nap," he could have said. "We just reunited."
She put on a jacket over the dress she was wearing, long and sleeveless. She'd bought it last week for this very day. Leo put on his sneakers. They followed the tram tracks to the river. Leo worried that they walked mostly in silence. Near the Ponte Sublicio, Leo took her hand.
"Farther down's my favorite bridge," Leo said eagerly. "We'll walk it later."
"Why trust the guide?" Once again, she was excited for their weekend ahead. Back in California, she'd felt a constant fluctuation of her attraction toward him. The first times they slept together, she found him almost repulsive. In their months of emailing, too, her image of him had swung back and forth. Sometimes it seemed that he heard her words exactly as she intended them, other times that he was deaf. At those moments, she would feel resentful. Before she arrived in Rome, her friends had joked about all the Italian men she'd meet in the course of the year. She'd felt, once or twice, a pang of injustice, as if her desires had been curbed, her freedom restricted. The person she described to Leo in her emails, a woman enchanted by the world, should by rights be enchanting others. Not that she'd met anyone, though who was to say that she wouldn't if she allowed herself to look. She'd practiced the route to the restaurant once before and plotted a path there through ivy-strung streets. She commended herself on her pick. The back garden was empty and sunny. The waiter tended to them with cheer, didn't show impatience at Leah's Italian. They got a plate of antipasto. Leo suggested beers. While they were waiting, Leah reached for his hands across the table, rubbed her palms up and down his arms. Afterward, they climbed the hill of the Giansicola, then surveyed the city from the Acqua Paola. Leah told him about the researchers at the university, exaggerating the character profiles for effect. She liked that he listened to her without interruption, kept track of names, didn't contest her point of view when she told him someone was annoying or boring, totally brilliant or a terrible scholar. Back in Trastevere, in the honey-tinted light, they sat down for Aperol spritzes. Their conversation was enlivened by tipsiness, their hands entangled restlessly over the table, touching insistently.
"Let's go home," Leah said.
She waved for the waiter. They walked back to the Ponte Sublicio. It was only later that she thought they should have taken a taxi instead. "Something strange happened on the plane," Leo said as they were crossing the bridge. He had his arm around her waist. Leah leaned into him, exaggerating her tipsiness, making a slow, sensual dance of it. "There was a woman next to me."
"Ooh," Leah said, "a beautiful woman?"
"She told me such a crazy story."
"I like crazy," she slurred.
"I felt like she hadn't talked to anyone in months. I felt so sorry for her."
"Are you trying to make me jealous?" Leah asked coyly.
Leo stopped walking. He took away his arm. He looked sad or disappointed, which Leah found patronizing. "She was really troubled," he said. "She was an old woman."
"Okay," Leah said. "You could have just said so. How was I supposed to know that?"
This was more or less the end of the conversation. Leah was too proud to ask him to tell her what the woman had said. Leo didn't offer to continue. Back in the apartment, Leo asked whether he'd somehow upset her, and if so, he was sorry. They were sitting at the kitchen table. Leah was sullen but preparing to let it go as soon as Leo made an advance. Instead, Leo apologized again and said that they should perhaps go to sleep. He was being decent, of course. He must have thought it would be wrong to make a move given her mood. In another situation, Leo would have considered it crude, even aggressive. But at this moment, his decency upset her even more.
"If that's what you prefer."
She got up and went to the bedroom,
aware that she was shutting down any opportunity to make up. She changed out of her clothes, put on a t-shirt and shorts. When Leo came in, she was lying with her back to the door. He fumbled around in his suitcase, tiptoed to the bathroom, slipped into bed. There were a few minutes of what seemed like charged mutual waiting, and then he was asleep. Leah thought with frustration about her smooth, soft legs, her lace underwear, now wasted. There had been, in fact, one opportunity since her arrival. The researchers from the linguistics department had met up on a Sunday to walk the Appian Way. Someone had invited a cousin, Ricardo, who arrived wearing a leather jacket and loafers. "Are we attempting Everest?" he asked, surveying the foreigners with their water bottles and sport clothes. He and Leah fell in line and ended up walking most of the path together. Ricardo told her the history of the trail, not suspecting that she might actually know far more about it than he did. Anyway, she didn't mind. He related his vague facts with animation, complimented Leah on her observations and questions, made outrageous jokes about the others. It felt special to be his accomplice. There was a picnic afterward, and the two of them split up to join separate conversations. When they were leaving, Ricardo told Leah he could drop her off since he lived near her. They went to a bar across from her apartment. During their second drink, she told him that she was seeing someone. Not to prevent anything from happening, exactly. She wanted to be guiltless in the aftermath, not to have led him astray. Perhaps she even liked the notion of being fought over. Ricardo had put a hand to her cheek. After a revelation, he took it away. Once they'd paid for the drinks, he told her good night. There was nothing romantic about Rome on a rainy day, not when you hadn't yet seen it enough in bright light. The city took time to get used to. You had to learn to love it without makeup, puffy-faced. But here it was, a rainy morning. The apartment was cold and damp. Leah brought out the electric heater from where she'd hidden it in her closet. They sat at the table in socks and sweaters, drinking tea. "We could go to the Palazzo Massimo," Leah said, "or the Borghese. In any case, we'll have to take a taxi." "Well, what would you prefer?" "I wanted us to walk through the park to get to the Borghese," Leah brooded, "but that's obviously out." "Well, let's do the other one, then." Once they were dressed, he came up to hug her. "I'm really glad to be here," he said. "Sorry, I was in a mood," Leah said. "I'm sorry, too." "I felt like I wasted our evening." "Well, we had a great evening," Leo said, "with a minor glitch." "I wasn't jealous or anything," Leah said. "I was just being silly." In the taxi, he told her the rest of the story. Leah didn't interrupt to point out the sights, though she was a bit sad he was missing them. The woman sitting next to Leo on the plane had been married at a very young age. Soon after the wedding, it became clear that there was something wrong with her husband. Nothing precise at first, just a sense that he was off balance. He was a meat salesman. That was how she'd met him, on her own doorstep. And she'd found out on a trip out of town that he was notorious in all the surrounding counties, where he was known as the Butcher. But it was too late. She was pregnant. After she gave birth, she and her child were held hostage by the Butcher for more than a decade. "Wait a second," Leah said. "What?" "This was all a very long time ago," Leo continued, "and it wasn't entirely like the horror stories one read about in newspapers. The woman still had some freedom, and she'd ultimately managed to leave with her daughter and make a life elsewhere. It wasn't a separation, though. She'd had to escape." Leo added that he was summarizing what had been a very complicated story. Somehow, the Butcher hadn't been able to find them again or disturb their lives. "You have to stop saying Butcher," Leo said. "This story is so messed up." "Well, that's what she called him," Leo said. "She didn't want to say his name, but it gets worse. She was actually coming back from the funeral."
"Whose funeral?"
"The Butcher's."
"Will you stop saying that?" Leah said. "And why would she go to his funeral?"
It was important for her daughter to be there, to have closure.
Is this woman Italian?
No, but she moved to Rome many years ago. She considers it her home. She became a painter, which was her dream before she met her husband.
B.S., Leah said. This can't be true.
Oh, it really is. She even won an award.
She became a painter and settled in Rome? She went to her torturer's funeral after a decade trying to escape?
People can start over, Leo said.
I don't know, Leo said. It's too much.
Well, you weren't there. They arrived at the Palazzo. Leah decided to drop it.
That's an awful story, she told him once they got their tickets. It must have been very upsetting to hear.
They headed to the gallery of frescoes. One room was painted like a garden, lush with birds and leaves. Entering it offered another perspective, cutting them off from the present tense. When they came out, it had stopped raining and the sun shone brightly. They stood on the steps, looking at the traffic. Suddenly, the day felt new and festive.
I'm starving, Leo said.
They ate salami panini standing at a kiosk and then walked all the way to the Fountain of Turtles, where they sat in the empty piazza.
Leo said he'd be content to do nothing else for the rest of the day. He was feeling very happy.
They returned home early, before dinner or drinks.
In imagining the act, she'd forgotten the facts. His rush to get to it, not roughness really, more like bashfulness, his reluctance to look at her for too long.
Back in California, she conceded to his haste, hadn't insisted that he slow down or that he meet her gaze. Now she was more demanding.
There was a twinge of antagonism in her touch, her hands directing him, yanking at him to stay still.
She hardly knew where it came from, whether she was putting on an act or letting resentment seep through. In any case, it was done. The sex needn't loom above them like an invisible boulder. In the morning, they stayed a while in bed, their skin acquainted, their conversation giddy. Breakfast was jam-filled cornetti at the cafe downstairs. And when they finished their second coffees, Leah suggested visiting the Vatican or the Forum.
I'm not letting you leave without some proper large-scale tourism.
Get some selfie sticks, Leo said. Some fanny packs and hats.
Leah liked this new familiarity, different from their emails. In the end, they went to the Borges Museum, walked through the park and down the Spanish Steps.
Leo had said that they might as well leave the big stuff for next time. This was another happy moment when he brought up his next visit. They ate heaping cups of gelato facing a church, and they both said that they were having a perfect day. At the university, Leo and Leah's names had become a joke among the researchers. Somehow, the coincidence made the relationship sound more serious, as if two people with such similar names were surely reunited in love, like Plato's soulmates cut in half at creation. The researchers were meeting up that weekend at a pub in Ostiense. Leah had told them she would try to come with Leo.
If you aren't too busy, the researcher joked predictably.
When Leo finished his gelato, she asked if he'd be up for going to the pub.
Well, as long as you're not embarrassed by me.
She liked him for saying that. They walked along the river to an industrial alleyway now occupied by bars. Leah's colleagues had taken a long table at the back. There were baskets of fried foods, empty glasses. People cheered when they walked in.
The double L chromosome, someone shouted.
The enthusiasm was not so much about Leah and Leo as it was about the opportunity to bond as a group in front of an outsider. Tomas, a researcher in Latin, put his arms around both of them.
How can we fill your fountains? He asked.
Leo asked for beer, Leah a glass of wine. As Tomas was walking to the bar, Leah saw Ricardo sitting at the far end of the table. She hadn't considered that he might be here. She felt a momentary panic. But nothing had happened between them, she reminded herself. If Ricardo was flirtatious, she could tell Leo that he'd been just like this on their first meeting as well. It would serve as one of her character portraits. Ricardo was listening to Rebecca, a scholar in digital archiving. He caught Leah's eyes and winked.
"Here we are again," he seemed to say, or, "well, well, look at you."
Leah felt a sudden pleasure as if there were stage lights directed at her. She took Leo around the table, introducing him one by one.
"Ricardo is an excellent guide to the Appian Way," she said, presenting him. Ricardo slapped Leo on the back. "Good to meet you, man. Have some of these fries before I eat them all."
It turned out that the company Ricardo worked for used a software similar to something Leo was working on. Leah knew very little about this topic and was surprised to see the two men hit it off. She and Rebecca had fallen into conversation out of necessity. After a while, Rebecca went to the toilet and then joined the others. Ricardo and Leo were now talking about music. Leah realized with annoyance that she'd eaten the entire basket of fries. She got up and put her hand on Leo's shoulder.
"Oh, hello," Leo said.
"This man's the man," Ricardo said.
He seemed to have forgotten about the evening with her.
"You haven't met anyone else," Leo said to Leo, "and it's already late."
He might have noticed the irritation in her tone. He probably thought she was acting moody for no reason.
"Well, let's talk to the others then," he said eagerly, as if to a child.
Everyone liked him. They proposed organizing a dinner for his next visit. Leo proposed having them over for fajitas, his specialty. Leah hadn't known about his specialty. She may not even have known that he cooked. Then he was pulled into another private conversation. Tomas was giving a long-winded explanation of his quest to make a comprehensive map of Umberto Eco's symbols. Leah tugged at Leo's arms and said that they should get going.
"She's the boss," Leo said to Tomas, arms spread to surrender.
"Whatever," Leah said. For his last day in Rome, they wrote out a list of things they wanted to do. They'd put aside anything requiring lines and tickets, but they decided to wake up early and walk to the Colosseum to see the exterior before the crowds arrived. Leah suggested the San Pietro in Vincoli, with Michelangelo's statue of Moses with the horns. She showed Leo on the map how they would then be right by Monte, which had a different feel from the neighborhoods they had been to. Leo traced with his finger and suggested a final evening stop at the Piazza di Trevi.
"Isn't that the famous fountain?"
"It's pretty tacky," Leah said. "We wouldn't be able to find a decent place to eat."
"Well, we can come home for dinner," Leo said. "I'll cook for you."
"Sounds delicious," Leah said. She got up and sat on his lap, straddling him. If only he were staying a bit longer, they would fall into perfect rhythm. Something had begun to loosen in the past few nights, though there was still the tug and pull, his hurry and her resentment, one perpetuating the other.
"Or maybe we can skip dinner," Leah said.
Leo said. If he stayed longer, she thought, he might even break free of his reserve. It was so easy for them to spend a day together. They were practical and spontaneous in all the same ways. They went through everything on their list, made discoveries in back streets. In Monte, Leo bought her a necklace of blue and green stones. Leah had been looking at it when he asked if he could get it for her. She'd been staring mindlessly, but she didn't say that she actually didn't like it that much. She put it on as they were leaving the shop. Leo told her it looked amazing. They bought wine and mushrooms and rice for dinner, and then took a taxi to the Trevi Fountain. They tried taking in the sight with all the people gathered around.
"Let's have a final gelato," Leo suggested.
"Well, this is probably the worst place in Rome for a gelato."
"Well, it's better than anything I'll have once I'm home."
On a side street, they got in line at a gelateria with rows of neon-colored options. "This is a tourist trap," Leah said. "Their servers aren't even Italian."
"Don't be a snob," Leo said. "I'm looking forward to the bubblegum flavor."
"Can you please miss your flight tomorrow?" Leah said. "We can have proper gelato."
Leo was holding her in an embrace, his face touching her neck. "No way," he said.
What's that supposed to mean?
No way, Leo repeated. I can't believe it. He let go of her. It's the woman from the plane.
She was standing at the back of the line in a red dress. She was smiling to herself as if practicing the look of someone having a lovely time. Her arms were bare, splotched purple with cold. Leah's instinct was to turn around before the woman spotted Leo, but Leo lifted both arms to wave. The woman cut the line and joined them.
This is my friend from the plane, Leo said, and this is Leah. Her name was Janet.
Do you live around here? Leo asked. Oh, basically, the woman said, flapping her hand vaguely. I mean, not so far. She told them that she came there most afternoons to treat herself.
It does you good, doesn't it? She said and laughed, which Leah found unsettling.
It was their turn to order. The server was in a rush, not keen on letting them try flavors. Leah repeated that the place was a tourist trap, and she got pistachio. Leo got stracciatella. Janet asked in English for a cup with strawberry and hazelnut and caramel. She asked for a wafer on top.
I'll get these, Leo said and reached for his wallet.
You're a darling, Janet said. Isn't he a darling?
Leah smiled.
What a treat, Janet said.
They walked together to the end of the street.
Well, it was very nice to meet you, Leah said. She knew that she was being abrupt, but she didn't want to risk the woman walking along with them. They parted, waving. When they were sufficiently distant, Leah told Leo that she'd been right.
About what?
About the fact that she's a pathological liar.
Whoa, Leo said.
She obviously doesn't live in Rome. She couldn't even order gelato.
Well, she did seem a bit clueless.
I mean, who would go there for gelato every afternoon?
The snob speaks.
Also, she really didn't look like a painter.
The snob strikes back.
I'm not a snob, Leah snapped. I'm just assessing the situation.
And what's your expert assessment? He didn't sound so playful now.
That you were duped.
Well, that's going a bit far, Leo said. Maybe she exaggerated a few things.
She made up a different identity. That's alarming behavior. She was almost shouting.
Well, you saw her, Leo said. She's harmless.
How is it that you're siding with a deranged stranger and being mean to me for pointing out the facts?
How is it that you're so upset? Leo said.
Because you're being willfully naive.
I can't take back the fact that I listened to her.
And why do you think she chose you as her audience?
Well, she said I had a kind face. Oh, aren't you lucky? She felt angry and stupid.
What's going on? Leo said. This is getting out of control. Let's just have a nice evening. Why are you so nice? Leah said. You're so nice to everyone but me.
You're being mean.
You feel sorry for the crazy lady on the plane? You let her talk to you for hours? You propose cooking for people you just met? You spend an entire evening listening to their pointless stories instead of spending time with me? She considered that she may have taken one step too far.
Are you talking about the pub? Leo said. I was making an effort with your friends.
Exactly, Leah said. You make an effort with everyone else.
They were in front of the Pantheon now, frightening and serene. This is quite a sight, Leo said. It was just like him, she thought, to avoid her reproach.
You know that guy, Ricardo? He actually came on to me, and you spent all evening chatting with him.
Well, I didn't know that, Leo said.
Even if you did, you wouldn't have cared.
That's not fair.
You would have cared more that he liked you.
Leo turned to face the building.
Leah had an urge to yank at his shoulder to make him look at her. What if I told you that something happened between us?
I guess that would be your free choice.
Stop it, Leah said. Just stop it, she was shouting now. Stop making me feel invisible.
Leo was silent. Maybe he mumbled something.
You might as well know that we spent the night together.
Even as she said it, she thought there would be an opportunity to take it back, explain that she was just trying to provoke him. After a moment, Leo asked, "Why are you telling me this?" She was astounded by the question, by the fact that he needed an explanation. They continued walking. "I'm sorry," she said. "I was upset. Nothing actually happened."
"Okay," Leo said. He looked tired.
Still, she was surprised that he didn't ask anything more. Certainly, she reasoned without conviction, it was the respectful thing to do. They went home. They made risotto. They made love. Leo packed his suitcase. His flight was early in the morning, a short one to London, then another to California. He would have to leave at sunrise. He told her that she should sleep. There was no need to get up.
"Don't be silly, Leosote. Of course I'm getting up."
She lay in bed while he showered and dressed. When she came into the kitchen, he was writing something at the table. He folded the paper, put it under the vase. Already the carnations were dry. He insisted that he didn't want breakfast. He'd just get something at the airport. Besides, his taxi was almost there. They went downstairs. "I've had an amazing time," Leo said and hugged her. Back in the apartment, Leah made tea and sat at the table. She composed a mental inventory of the visit, combing through the events several times in a row. Each time, the scales tipped more toward success than disappointment. In the note folded under the vase, Leo repeated what a great time he'd had. He said that he was looking forward to the next visit, if he was invited. He'd underlined "if," though Leah couldn't quite tell what sort of effect he'd intended. It almost seemed sarcastic. There was nothing for him to apologize for, and so he hadn't. Leah had been wondering about something on and off during the past days. She realized now that she hadn't had a chance to ask how had Leo responded to the woman's story. What had he actually said to her on the plane? She doubted that he had posed any questions. He wouldn't have wanted to pry or to say something wrong. Leah could picture him listening so silently that it wasn't clear if he was listening at all. She felt for a moment on Janet's side, sympathetic that the woman had had to tilt her story further toward invention to make sure that the quiet, kind-seeming man would continue to keep her company. Next, from the Critic at Large section of the January 24, 2022 issue of the New Yorker magazine, "Bambi is even bleaker than you thought." The original book is far more grisly than the beloved Disney classic and has an unsettling message about humanity, by Catherine Schultz. It is one of the most famous murders in the history of cinema. A mother and her child are out for a walk on the first warm day after a bitter winter. Beguiled by the changing weather, we do not see the danger coming. In fact, we never see it at all, because the man with the gun remains off screen. We see only the mother's sudden alarm, her panicked attempt to get her child to safety, their separation in the chaos of the moment, and then the child, outside in the cold as snow once again begins to fall, alone and crying for his mother. The film in question is, of course, the 1942 Walt Disney classic Bambi. Perhaps more than any other movie made for children, it is remembered chiefly for its moments of terror. Not only the killing of the hero's mother, but the forest fire that threatens all the main characters with annihilation. Stephen King called Bambi the first horror movie he ever saw, and Pauline Kael, the longtime film critic for this magazine, claimed that she had never known children to be as frightened by supposedly scary grown-up movies as they were by Bambi. Unlike many other Disney classics, from Cinderella to Frozen, this fright fest is not based on a fairy tale. It was adapted from Bambi, A Life in the Woods, a 1922 novel by the Austro-Hungarian writer and critic Felix Salten. The book rendered Salten famous. The movie, which altered and overshadowed its source material, rendered him virtually unknown. And it rendered the original Bambi obscure, too, even though it had previously been both widely acclaimed and passionately reviled.
The English language version, as translated in 1928 by the soon-to-be Soviet spy Whittaker Chambers, was enormously popular, earning rave reviews and selling 650,000 copies in the dozen-plus years before the film came out. The original version, meanwhile, was banned and burned in Nazi Germany, where it was regarded as a parable about the treatment of Jews in Europe. As that suggests, Bambi the book is even darker than Bambi the movie. Until now, English language readers had to rely on the Chambers translation, which, thanks to a controversial copyright ruling, has been the only one available for almost a century. This year, however, Bambi, A Life in the Woods has entered the public domain, and the Chambers version has been joined by a new one, the original Bambi, The Story of a Life in the Forest, published by Princeton, translated by Jack Zipes, with wonderful black and white illustrations by Alinka Sattler. Zipes, a professor emeritus of German and comparative literature at the University of Minnesota, who has also translated the fairy tales of the Brothers Grimm, maintains in his introduction that Chambers got Bambi almost as wrong as Disney did. Which raises two questions. How exactly did a tale about the life of a fawn become so contentious? And what is it really about? Felix Salten was an unlikely figure to write Bambi, since he was an ardent hunter who, by his own estimate, shot and killed more than 200 deer. He was also an unlikely figure to write a parable about Jewish persecution, since, even after the book burnings, he promoted a policy of appeasement toward Nazi Germany. And he was an unlikely figure to write one of the most famous children's stories of the 20th century, since he wrote one of its most infamous works of child pornography. These contradictions are nicely encapsulated by Beverly Driver Eddy in her biography, Felix Salten, Man of Many Faces. Born Sigmund Salzmann in Hungary in 1869, Salten was just 3 weeks old when his family moved to Vienna, a newly desirable destination for Jews, because Austria had lately granted them full citizenship. His father was a descendant of generations of rabbis who shook off his religious roots in favor of a broad-minded humanism. He was also a hopelessly inept businessman who soon plunged the family into poverty. To help pay the bills, Salten started working for an insurance company in his teens, around the same time that he began submitting poetry and literary criticism to local newspapers and journals. Eventually, he began meeting other writers and creative types at a cafe called the Greinsteidl, across the street from the National Theater. These were the fin de siècle artists, collectively known as Young Vienna. Salten was, in his youth, both literally and literarily promiscuous. He openly conducted many affairs with chambermaids, operetta singers, actresses, a prominent socialist activist, and, serially or simultaneously, several women with whom other members of Young Vienna were having dalliances as well. In time, he married and settled down. But all his life he wrote anything he could get paid to write. His detractors regarded this torrent as evidence of hackery, but it was more straightforwardly evidence of necessity. Almost alone among the members of Young Vienna, he was driven by the need to make a living. Both his personal judgment and his critical judgment could be impulsive and errant. In his 30s, he borrowed prodigiously to produce a modernist cabaret of the kind that was all the rage in Berlin, only to see it become a critical and financial catastrophe. The production that brought Salten the most infamy, however, did not bear his name. Josephine Mutzenbacher, or The Story of a Viennese Whore as Told by Herself. Published anonymously in Vienna in 1906, it has been continuously in print since then in both German and English and has sold some 3 million copies. Despite the subtitle, no one ever seems to have entertained the possibility that it was written by a prostitute or even by a woman. In Salten's lifetime, nearly everyone thought he wrote it, except for those who liked him too much to believe he could produce something so filthy, and those who hated him too much to believe that he could produce something so well written. Salten himself twice claimed not to have been responsible for it, but otherwise was silent or coy on the subject. These days, everyone from academics to the Austrian government regards him as the undisputed author. Written in the tradition of the ribald female memoir, a la Fanny Hill,
Josephine Mutzenbacher recounts the sexual adventures of the title character beginning when she is 5 years old and continuing after her turn to prostitution in her early teens, following the death of her mother. Today, what is most shocking about the book is Josephine's youth. At the time, however, most of the scandal concerned her unapologetic embrace of her career, which she both enjoyed and credited with lifting her out of poverty, educating her, and introducing her to a world far wider than the impoverished Vienna suburbs where she, like Salton, grew up. Perhaps inevitably, scholars have tried to draw parallels between Josephine Mutzenbacher and Bambi. Both title characters lose their mothers while still in their youth. Both books introduce readers in detail to urban borderlands, the poor suburbs, the flophouses, the forest, about which most proper Viennese were largely ignorant. Still, for the most part, such comparisons seem strained. If there is a through line to Salton's scattershot career, it is his interest in writing about animals, which was evident from his first published work of fiction, The Vagabond, a short story about the adventures of a dachshund, written when he was 21. Many other non-human protagonists followed, most of them ill-fated. A sparrow that dies in battle, a fly that hurls itself to death against a windowpane. Salton's novel, The Hound of Florence, concerns a young Austrian man destined to spend every other day of his life as the Archduke's dog. In the end, he is stabbed to death, in his dog form, while trying to protect a courtesan he loves from assault. In an even more drastic transformation than the one Bambi underwent, this story became, in Disney's hands, The Shaggy Dog. And then, of course, there is Bambi, which, like these other stories, was not particularly suitable for children until Disney bolderized it to fit the bill. If you haven't seen the Disney version of Bambi since you were 8, here is a quick refresher. The title character is born one spring to an unnamed mother and a distant but magnificently antlered father. He befriends an enthusiastic young rabbit, Thumper, a sweet-tempered skunk, Flower, and a female fawn named Feline. After the death of his mother, the following spring, he and Feline fall in love. But their relationship is tested by a rival deer, by a pack of hunting dogs, and finally by the forest fire. Having triumphed over all three, Bambi sires a pair of fawns. As the film concludes, the hero, like his father before him, is watching over his family from a faraway crag. Bambi was not particularly successful when it was first released. It was hampered partly by audience turnout, which was down because of the Second World War, and partly by audience expectations, since, unlike earlier Disney productions, it featured no magic and no Mickey. In time, though, Bambi, which was Walt's favorite among his films, became one of the most popular movies in the history of the industry. In the 4 decades following its release, it earned $47 million, more than 10 times the haul of Casablanca, which came out the same year. Perhaps more notably, it also earned a dominant position in the canon of American nature tales. In the words of the environmental historian Ralph Lutz, it is difficult to identify a film, story, or animal character that has had a greater influence on our vision of wildlife. That vision is of an Eden marred only by the incursion of humankind. There is no native danger in Bambi's forest, with the exception of his brief clash with another male deer in mating season, and maybe that hardscrabble winter. The wilderness he inhabits is all natural beauty and interspecies amity. The truly grave threats he faces are always from hunters, who cause both the forest fire and the death of his mother. Yet the movie seems less anti-hunting than simply anti-human. The implicit moral is not so much that killing animals is wicked, as that people are wicked and wild animals are innocent. Unsurprisingly, Bambi has long been unpopular among hunters, nor is the film a favorite among professional wilderness managers, who now routinely contend with what they call the Bambi complex, a dangerous desire to regard nature as benign and wild animals as adorable and tame. But perhaps the most vociferous, if also the smallest group of critics, consists of the devotees of Salton, who recognize how drastically Disney distorted his source material. Although the animals in the novel do converse and in some cases befriend one another across species, their overall relations are far from benign. In the course of just 2 pages, a fox tears apart a widely beloved pheasant,
A ferret fatally wounds a squirrel, and a flock of crows attacks the young son of friend Hare, the gentle, anxious figure who becomes Thumper in the movie, leaving him to die in excruciating pain. Later, Bambi himself nearly batters to death a rival who is begging for mercy, while Feline looks on, laughing. Far from being gratuitous, such scenes are, in the author's telling, the whole point of the novel. Salton insisted that he wrote Bambi to educate naive readers about nature as it really is, a place where life is always contingent on death, where starvation, competition, and predation are the norm. That motive did not make Salton go easy on human beings. On the contrary, his depiction of our impact on nature is considerably more specific and violent than the one in the film, not to mention sadder. Consider the moment when Bambi, fleeing the hunting party that kills his mother and countless other creatures, comes across the wife of friend Hare in a scene that reads like something out of Regeneration, Pat Barker's novel about the First World War. It reads as follows. "Can you help me a little?" she said. Bambi looked at her and shuddered. Her hind leg dangled lifelessly in the snow, dyeing it red and melting it with warm, oozing blood. "Can you help me a little?" she repeated. She spoke as if she were well and whole, almost as if she were happy. "I don't know what can have happened to me," she went on. "There's really no sense to it, but I just can't seem to walk." In the middle of her words, she rolled over on her side and died. What purpose are scenes like that one serving in this book? Salton maintained that, despite his own affinity for hunting, he was trying to dissuade others from killing animals, except when it was necessary for the health of a species or an ecosystem. But authors do not necessarily get the last word on the meaning of their work, and plenty of other people believe that Bambi is no more about animals than Animal Farm is. Instead, they see in it what the Nazis did, a reflection of the anti-Semitism that was on the rise all across Europe when Salton wrote it. As a textual matter, the best evidence for this proposition comes from two parts of Bambi that never made it onto the screen. The first concerns Feline's twin brother Gobo, who was written out of the movie. A fragile and sickly fawn, Gobo cannot flee during the hunting rampage that kills Bambi's mother and friend Hare's wife. For several months, he is presumed dead. Then, one day, Bambi and Feline spot a deer making its way across an open meadow with reckless nonchalance, as if oblivious to any possible peril. This newcomer turns out to be the grown-up Gobo, who, we learn, was rescued by a member of the hunting party, taken into his home and nursed back to health. When Gobo returns, the other forest animals gather to hear him describe the kindness of the hunter and his family, the warmth of the dwelling, and the meals that were brought to him every day. Most of them think that Gobo's time among the humans has made him dangerously naive, but he is convinced that it has made him wiser and more worldly. "You all think he's wicked," he tells them. In Salton's books, humans are typographically styled the way God is, singular and capitalized. "But he isn't wicked. If he loves anybody or if anybody serves him, he's good to him, wonderfully good." Every subjugated minority is familiar with figures like Gobo, individuals who have assimilated into and become defenders of the culture of their subjugators, whether out of craven self-interest or because, like Gobo, they are sincerely enamored of it and convinced that their affection is reciprocated. Such figures often elicit the disdain or the wrath of their peers, and Salton leaves little doubt about how he feels. Bambi was ashamed of Gobo without knowing why, Salton writes, and the half-tamed deer soon pays the price for his beliefs. One day, ignoring the advice of other animals, Gobo strolls into the meadow, even though the scent of humans fills the air. He is confident that they won't harm him, but he is shot in the flank while his love interest looks on. As she turns to flee, he sees the hunter bent over Gobo and hears his wailing death shriek. One understands why Disney left that part out. So, too, a scene in Salton's book where a dog kills a fox, which unfolds at a horrifyingly leisurely pace. The fox's paw is shattered and bleeding, and he knows he will die soon. But he pleads with the dog, "Let me die with my family, at least. We're brothers almost, you and I." When that fails, he accuses the dog of being a turncoat and a spy. The dog works himself into a frenzy, defending the virtue and the power of his master, and then itemizes all the other animals who serve humankind.
The horse, the cow, the sheep, the chickens, many, many of you and your kind are on his side and worship him and serve him.
They're rabble, snarled the fox, full of boundless contempt. It is easy in light of these scenes to see why some people interpret Bandy as a covert account of the crisis facing European Jews in the 1920s, a story about innocent creatures forced to remain constantly vigilant against danger, from would-be betrayers within and proto-brown shirts without. In 1925, 3 years after Bambi, Salton published New People on Ancient Soil, the product of a visit to Palestine and a book-length tribute to his friend's dream of a Jewish state. A decade later, his books, together with countless others by Jewish authors, were burned by the Nazis, and 2 years after that, following Germany's annexation of Austria, he moved to Switzerland. Salton died in Zurich at the age of 76, 4 months after Hitler killed himself. Does all this make Bambi a parable about Jewish persecution? The fact that the Nazis thought so is hardly dispositive. Fascist regimes are not known for their sophisticated literary criticism, and for every passage that supports such a reading, numerous others complicate or contradict it. Many critics see in Bambi different or more diffuse political sentiments, from a generalized opposition to totalitarianism to a post-First World War commentary on the brutality of modern combat. All of these readings are plausible, including the specifically Jewish one and Salton's own interpretation of his work as a plea for greater understanding of the natural world. Yet the most striking and consistent message of the book is neither obliquely political nor urgently ecological. It is simply grimly existential. Whatever else Bambi may be, it is at heart a coming-of-age story, a novel of education and training. The agent of that education is a character known as the Old Prince, the oldest surviving stag in the forest, and the lessons he imparts are not subtle. When he first encounters Bambi, the latter is still a fawn, dismayed because his mother has lately grown distant, pushing him away when he tries to nurse, walking off without caring whether he is following. Thus rebuffed, he is by himself in the middle of the forest bleeding for her when the old prince appears and scolds him. "Your mother has no time for you now," the old prince says. "Can't you stay by yourself? Shame on you!" That, in two sentences, is the ultimate message of Bambi. Anything short of extreme self-reliance is shameful, interdependence is unseemly, restrictive, and dangerous. Salton writes, "Of all his teachings, this had been the most important. You must live alone if you wanted to preserve yourself, if you understood existence, if you wanted to attain wisdom, you had to live alone." The curious thing about this insistence on solitude is that nothing in the book makes it seem appealing. The chief trajectory of Bambi's life is not from innocence to wisdom. It's from contentment and companionship to isolation and bare-bones survival. Stranger still, this valorization of loneliness seems unrelated to the book's second explicit moral, which concerns the relationship between human beings and other animals. In the final pages, the old prince takes Bambi, himself now old and beginning to gray, to see something in the woods, a dead man, shot and killed by another hunter. Amazingly, Walt Disney planned to include this scene in his film, excising it only after the sight of the corpse made an entire test audience leap out of their seats. With the old prince's prompting, Bambi concludes from this experience, not that we humans are a danger even unto one another, but rather that other animals are foolish for imagining that we are gods merely because we are powerful. There is another who is over us all, he realizes while contemplating the dead man, over us and over him. The old prince, satisfied that his work is done, goes off to die. What are we to make of this muddy, many-minded story? Zipes, in his introduction, blames some of the confusion on Chambers, contending that he mistranslated Salton, flattening both the political and the metaphysical dimensions of the work, and paving the way for Disney to turn it into a children's story. But that claim is borne out neither by examples in the introduction nor by a comparison of the two English versions, which differ mainly on aesthetic grounds. In both versions, the Bambi that emerges is a complex work, part nature writing, part allegory, part autobiography. What makes it such a startling source for a beloved children's classic is ultimately not its violence or its sadness, but its bleakness. Perhaps the most telling exchange in the book occurs during that difficult winter between Bambi's mother and his aunt. "It's hard to believe that it will ever be better," his mother says. His aunt responds, "It's hard to believe that it was ever any better." It's tempting to read those lines, too, as a commentary on the Jewish condition, if only because, to this Jew's ear, at least, they had the feel of classic Jewish dark humor, realistic, linguistically dexterous and grim. Yet no one alive today can regard such a sentiment as exclusive to any subgroup. It is simply a way of seeing the world, one that can be produced by circumstance, temperament, or, as in Salton's case, both. Reading him, one suspects that the conventional interpretation of his most famous work is backward. Bambi is not a parable about the plight of the Jews, but Salton sometimes regards the plight of the Jews as a parable about the human condition. The omnipresence and inevitability of danger, the need to act for oneself and seize control of one's fate, the threat posed by intimates and strangers alike, this is Salton's assessment of our existence. One of the forgotten novelist's most forgotten novels, Friends from All Over the World, is set in a zoo that is maintained by an enlightened and human zookeeper, yet remains intrinsically a place of suffering and cruelty. The animals within it, Salton writes, are all sentenced to life imprisonment and are all innocent. That is a lovely line, and one that seems to apply in his moral universe to all of us. In the forest, that is, in a state of nature, we are in constant danger. In society, tended and cared for but fundamentally compromised, we are still not out of the woods. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New York readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, that is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.